George Washington. It's one of the most recognizable names in the world. His story is a foundational stone in American history. Yet at the place he was born, only remnants remain of the buildings and the stories of people who once lived here. One might think that the birthplace of a national icon is an easy story to tell, but it's actually one of the most complex and surprising historic sites preserved by the National Park Service. So join us as we piece together the past, present, and future of this place, brick by brick, on this podcast series, Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments. In the 18th century, as people began to expand west, stories emerged of trees that took 30 men holding hand in hand to wrap themselves around, waterfalls that were thousands of feet tall, bubbling mud pots and geysers. These stories sounded like fiction, and they were not to be believed until artists found themselves in these locations and captured the scenery firsthand on canvas. Through their awe-inspiring works, the public came to see these special places in America for the first time. The works captured their imaginations, spurring them to preserve these lands for future generations. Hi, I'm Dustin Baker, and I'm the Chief of Interpretation at George Washington Birthplace National Monument. Today, art continues to thrive in our national parks. The sights and sounds in national parks continue to inspire artists who communicate that inspiration through painting, photography, poetry, and more. But how do you take intangible inspiration from a site like this and turn it into art? What medium would you use and why? It's National Park Week, and on this episode, we are going to ask that very question to our most recent volunteer artist in residence. Celine Jarvis is a textile and fiber artist working primarily in historical spinning, weaving, and natural dye techniques. She embraces the value of making functional objects as a way to explore the intricate beauty of early American textiles. Her use of natural dyes utilizes local plants, linking the work to a physical location and capturing memory and fabric. Interviewing Celine Jarvis is myself and lead interpretive park ranger Jonathan Malriott.
So, Celine, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, sure. I live locally. I grew up in the area, and this is my first residency. I'm a hand weaver and spinner, natural dyer. I do a lot of different textile arts, very interested in historical textile arts. And yeah, I've been here since February doing a lot of spinning and dyeing and working with local natural materials at the park.
So, Artist in Residence program is a national initiative that the Park Service has been doing. Dustin explained what Artist in Residence is and what that means here at George Washington Birthplace.
So the relationship between artists and national parks goes all the way back to the very inception of preserving beautiful landscapes for the benefit of all people. Thinking all the way back to the 19th century, the Hudson River school painters, Albert Bierstadt, Thomas Cole, Frederick Edwin Church, going out and documenting Western landscapes and those paintings and images making their way back to the East and convincing people in government to preserve these places. It really speaks to art has always been there when it comes to the history of the national parks. And I think everyone knows what I mean when you go to some national parks and you're just immediately hit with this surreal beauty of the landscapes. And artists can communicate that in many different ways, very many different mediums. And so the Artist in Residence program is really something that's kind of been there all along when you think about it. There's always been people painting these landscapes and photographing them. And today we, you know, can broaden that into all different kinds of mediums. And with the Artist in Residency program here, actually using materials from the landscape to create that art.
So you are the one who implemented the Artist in Residence program here at George Washington Birthplace. It's the first time we've had it. What was the motive behind wanting to do that?
Well, for me, I think when people think George Washington Birthplace, they do not come prepared for how beautiful this park is. And it really is, it's scenic. It has lots of flora and fauna that you can't find in very many other places. And it is an exceptionally beautiful place. But for me personally, this was an important program to implement because I actually got my career started in 2011 as an artist in residence. And I was the sculptor in residence for two seasons at Mount Rushmore National Memorial. And it actually really makes talking to young people fun. People who ask, one of the most common questions we get is, how did you get your job in the National Park Service? And I think the answer people expect is studying, you know, geology or some kind of natural science. But to say, you know, I began as an artist and you could too, really opens people's eyes to all the possibilities that our National Park Service sites hold, both in terms of career opportunities, volunteer opportunities, but also what's important to, you know, something kind of impersonal like the federal government. It's surprising to people to think about that there's actually art programs that are funded and sponsored by, you know, our federal government.
So Celine, you were the first artist in residence here at George Washington Birthplace. What interested you in becoming an artist in residence volunteer?
Yeah, it's a great question. My first introduction to George Washington's Birthplace National Monument was actually through 4-H. As a kid, I did 4-H here at the park and would run around and volunteer and just got to enjoy being in the park. And I loved that. And I have come to now be finishing my studies in textiles, historic textiles focused. And I had heard of artists in residence programs in national parks, but I didn't know that that was an option here, or I wasn't even thinking about that being an option here. Actually, when I reached out, I was just curious about what was going on at the park currently. I had remembered coming here as a kid and seeing the weaving studio and just wanting to get more involved in my local community and involved in historic textiles and right where I live. So I had reached out and was put in touch with Dustin. And when I came here, we got talking about the Artist in Residence program, and it just seemed like a really wonderful fit for what I was doing currently. And it kind of just grew out of, yeah, having that conversation about how parks can be, they have so much to offer, and especially for artists, it's been a really great place to be. But I didn't exactly come here with the intention of starting out at the residency, but I'm so glad that that's what happened. Worked out really wonderfully.
What were some of the things that you did as an artist in residence? Because that's a pretty encompassing term.
Yeah, I worked a lot with, there's a flock of Hog Island sheep that reside at the Memorial Farm, and I was able to get their fleece and process that entirely from just the raw fleece off the sheep to a finished woven shawl. I even was able to use some of the walnuts that were growing here at the park to dye it. I did a lot of natural dyeing, some with plants that were here. So I was able to work with the Northern Neckmaster Gardeners some with the dye garden here, getting that, getting some plants in and using some of those, which was really exciting. I did lots of natural dyeing, some with things that weren't grown around here, but still were fun to work with. Some stitching. I did a lot of writing. I really enjoyed the peacefulness of this park. It's it can be pretty quiet, which is lovely for just writing and sketching and enjoying the gardens and the trails and sitting and drawing shorebirds or flowers and just really sitting with the land. Did a lot of that.
Yeah, I think one thing to add is that, you know, you ended up making these beautiful works and, but it was more than that. You were using, you know, a spinning wheel and using techniques and technology that people would have had in the colonial era when they lived here during, you know, George Washington's time and his family's time here. And so I think for me, the most exciting thing to see was that blending of past and present, using old Lifeway techniques to make modern art was something I was really excited to, you know, start talking about with you when we first met each other. And yeah, it's stuff that people would like to have in their homes, I'm sure. You know, the stuff you created, it's stuff that I think is modern, but it has that old world touch to it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that comes through a lot with, like you say, using these historic techniques to make contemporary pieces. Using plants, using wool, raw wool, in a really, in a historical way, but also in this experimental, fun ways as well. Yeah, that's been so rewarding to be able to use so much material from the area.
Yeah, and we didn't really put you in a box or put any kind of guardrails on the direction that you went in. We just kind of put some tools in front of you and, you know, told you what materials you could and could not use in the park. And yeah, it's just so fascinating to see all the stuff that you were able to make, just, you know, manifesting it from the natural resources here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I may have confused some visitors or not confused, but it led to a lot of interesting conversations when they would see me working with a spinning wheel or with a table loom or something that they would associate with a more historical object. And yeah, these are historical techniques for sure that I'm using, but getting to use them in a modern or fresh way was really fun to have those conversations with people and also show them, yeah, this is exactly how carding wool would have been done in 1750 or knitting. So.
Yeah. And one thing you really taught me a lot about was all the natural dye plants that are even just in the memorial area of the park. I mean, so many plants now I see with a totally different point of view.
Oh yeah. You can't unsee it once you start identifying them. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. I remember this spring we did the scavenger hunt for kids with different dye plants and things. I've loved getting to share that little bit of excitement about dye plants or plants in general or textiles with kids has been so fun.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask you is that, you know, artists tend to see the world in a special way, kind of through a unique lens. And what do you personally think was the most beautiful part about the landscape here? And how would you explain it to someone who isn't an artist?
That's a great question. I think, well, some of the things that I found really striking, well, one, being here for a long period of time, I got to see, you know, the leaves emerge on the trees and the garden come up and then the summer flowers really be in full bloom. And now things are changing again with it being fall. Colors are changing and leaves are falling and seeing migrating birds come and return. When I first got here, there were the tundra swans. And now I think it's the geese, some geese that have come. But yeah, getting to see these like cyclical patterns in nature and thinking about that a lot in my work while I'm here. And the patterns that repeat themselves in nature and in history, and thinking a lot about the people that have been here before us. And it's a very special place. There's a lot of history here. And I loved getting to sit and write and just thinking about how I get to enjoy it and look out over the same water that, you know, people have looked out at for hundreds of years. And yeah, really spending a lot of time writing during this residency, getting to think through some of those themes of seasons and circles and different people through history and their experiences here.
Yeah, and it's so hard to put into words. I think that's why artists exist, because you're taking something that, you know, is unspeakable, it's intangible, it's unknown, and you're presenting it in a visual form instead of with words. So it's hard to kind of articulate that.
It is. Yeah, I found a lot of repetitive stitching work to be a good way that I could think through some things like that. And it may not look direct when you look at the piece, but there's a lot of those thoughts and meditations just as I'm working on it. I'm thinking and just considering the land around me.
So I know as an artist in residence, like, the name's indicative, you probably did a lot of art, but was there any surprising thing that you did as an artist in residence that you didn't expect when you started?
Yeah. I was not prepared to talk to so many people, I guess, that I have really enjoyed it. That was not a bad thing at all. But getting to talk and engage with the visitors so much was really exciting. Especially the kids. I loved getting to talk to the kids. I can remember coming here as a kid, or places like Ferry Farm or Williamsburg or Yorktown, any of the historical sites, and just getting so excited to talk to someone showing a craft. And maybe that's just because I'm a nerd, but I always really enjoyed it. So getting to share that with kids was super fun, and letting them feel different wool or even try their hand at spinning or something. I just loved getting to engage with the visitors. That was a little bit unexpected. A good surprise though. And also just how much time I would have to sit and sketch out ideas and think through concepts. Usually when I'm working, it's a very, like, I have an idea and I just want to get my hands on it and start making. And I definitely did a lot of making here, but there was a lot of contemplative time for writing and just enjoying the scenery and sketching ideas out, really planning stuff.
Did any questions that visitors asked you or anything really stick out?
Let me think. Well, a lot of people thought that I was a reenactor, which I wasn't. I was using historical techniques like we've talked about, but I wasn't a reenactor. Got a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
But it was always exciting when there was someone who had a connection with fiber arts. And I always really enjoyed when there was someone who would say, oh, my grandmother had a spinning wheel, or my aunt was a quilter, or my sister does weaving. And we could have a whole conversation about textiles and how it had affected them, because textiles do affect all of us. Like, we all wear cloth every day, and it's just such a part of human existence. So it was really exciting to have this tiny community for a moment with visitors over fabric.
So I'm assuming over a year, you probably felt like you've changed a lot, but is there any one change as an artist or an individual that you felt was either most impactful for you or something that you really took away from this year out here at George Washington Birthplace?
Ooh, that is a great question. I don't feel that my art has, like, fundamentally changed or anything, but I do think that my time here has really let me sink into this language of working with plants that I was starting to come into. And I've done a lot of natural dyeing for a number of years now, but that language of working with plants as a way to connect yourself to a place, I think really honed in here, and being able to think about using material from a location and how that links a person to the artwork and to a specific time, to a specific place. That concept is something that I'm really excited about in the future, continuing with and just getting to be able to understand that even more.
Yeah, it almost seems like magic to mm-hmm. be able to extract color and material from just the plants that people walk past every day.
Yeah, for sure. And it just, you know, it makes everything part of that circle. You know, you're like with the walnuts that I used here, I was gathering them and they're putting off oxygen at the park that all of us here are breathing. And then now it's in a piece of fabric that someone could wear. And when I was finished dyeing, I put the walnuts in my compost pile and they'll become soil for next year's dye garden. And it's just, you know, linking everything together, I think, a really exciting way.
So Dustin, I know Celine reached out to you, but is there any reason that you were thinking that Celine should be our first artist in residence? Was there anything about either her repertoire or the way she approached you that stuck out?
Yeah. So, you know, piloting an artist in residence program at George Washington Birthplace had kind of been in the back of my mind, but I didn't really know what that looked like. Was thinking of, well, people have painted portraits of George. We only know George Washington's appearance through painting and sculpture. So maybe it could be something in that realm. I wasn't even in the same neighborhood as Celine's medium, but when she came and I met her and we walked around and she was saying what she was interested in doing here and wanting to volunteer, and she told me about her background, I'd like, in real time as we were walking, I was like, wait a minute, like, this is art you're talking about. This isn't, you know, this isn't something else. This is an art form, because we're talking about color. We're talking about creating from scratch using, you know, the things that we're literally walking past as we talk. And I immediately saw that what I was saying earlier about blending old world with new world, because I didn't want to say, hey, you know, I want you to come here, spin up the spinning wheel and make some socks.
Yeah.
You know, I was really thinking about modern art, but people using that as a vehicle to connect to old world life ways here that people from George Washington's family and the people who lived on the shores of Pope's Creek would recognize.
Yeah, I think that was definitely accomplished with some of the stuff that was made during my time here. And I think you brought up painting and talking about George Washington again. And yeah, we think so much about, like, we're at George Washington's birthplace. But there is something very, I don't know, the sort of, like, textiles can get overlooked, I think. And they're just so present in our lives. And thinking about, they can be kind of humble, but they're really, I don't know where I'm going with that. I'm thinking a lot about all the women that were here too. And it is primarily women that are doing the textile arts, the spinning and the dyeing and the wool processing. That is primarily women. And there is a lot of women behind the Washington family. It was interesting to think about while I was doing all of these crafts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in our world today, especially for young people, textiles and clothing can almost seem kind of disposable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, almost single use. You buy it, you wear it,
you get a mustard stain on it, you throw it out. But really seeing how much went into every single piece you made, made me think about what it would have been like in the 17th and 18th century here and how special each textile object would have been, how much of a gift it would be to have a shirt or pair of pants made for you. And it really makes me look at the colonial era in a whole different way that I'm sure a lot of people have already, you know, thought about, but it was new to me to think about how each item you had was, you know, hours and hours and hours of work put into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was thinking so much about just the monumentous amount of labor that was done here, and is done to make anything by hand. But yeah, just the coming here a few hours a week and working, but thinking about doing that spinning day in, day out, maintaining crops of flax or the sheep herds, anything you would need to produce cloth. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of labor.
Yeah. So.
I mean, I know you said that you got some of the wool from the sheep here. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to process? And have you finished processing all of it yet?
I still have some left over. The stuff that I did use, I probably used a third. So there's is there six sheep here? Mm-hmm. So I guess I used about two sheep's worth of wool, if you wanted to look at it that way. And I wrote, it was several dozen hours. Yeah, it was just cleaning it alone is a huge process. And then there's carding and spinning, dyeing, weaving. It's a lot of hours.
So I know like one of the pieces you have on exhibit is a scarf. Mm-hmm. If you had to take a guess at how many hours it took you to complete that scarf from start to finish, just to put that in mind for our audience, because like, oh, we can go to the store. It takes us 20 minutes to get to the store. We get the shirt and there we go. That's it.
Yeah. The spinning was the longest part. That for sure just took forever. I would estimate probably about 40 hours of work.
So 40 hours for one scarf, a whole work week.
Yeah. That's from sheep all the way to a finished product. But yeah.
So, I mean, that really goes to show you how intensive it was to be able to create things historically.
Yeah. And just think about how many things like that were made here that are lost forever, just because, you know, textile itself is ephemeral in the sense that it degrades and disappears.
Yeah. We're not digging up any fragments of clothing usually.
Right. Why do you think it might be important for someone of the next generation to learn these skills?
I think that they're just such important skills. Some of the people that I have learned these things from are an older generation. And it seemed to me with talking to the visitors, a lot of the people that had the strongest connection were an older generation. And I just think it's really valuable to preserve some of these traditions or techniques so they're not lost, and so that younger generations and children coming into the world have an appreciation for things that are handmade, have an understanding at least of some sort of understanding of what goes into making objects by hand and the value of that and the time that goes into it and the respect for nature if you're using naturally gathered materials. I think that it's a whole way of life you can get talking about for sure. But boils down to, I guess, just keeping these handcrafts alive. There's a whole list of endangered craft. And when you look at it, there's so many things on that list that you would never even think about, like, you know, hat making or certain broom making techniques. And yeah, making things by hand is important. Oh gosh, I completely lost what I was going to say. Oh yeah, the community that you can find in craft and in making things by hand, I have found to be so, I mean, just a huge part of my life. Some of my closest friends are in that craft community. And I think that you can just find a lot of friendship, a lot of connection with people in it, over similar ways of life.
So any final advice that you'd have for either someone looking to get into the textile arts or even someone who's interested in doing an artist in residence program for themselves?
Yeah, I would say if you're interested in getting into textile arts, one of the great things about textiles is how accessible it is. And it's pretty available to most people. It doesn't cost a lot to get some yarn or knitting needles. And there's so many different types of textile art that you could try out. So if knitting isn't for you, maybe you enjoy felting or embroidery. There's just lots of different things you could pick up and reach out and ask people. People love to share their craft and are always happy, in my experience, always happy to talk about that and share some of their knowledge with you. I think that that's something I really love about textiles and just how easy they are to bring with you everywhere. And for the residencies, again, I think just reaching out to organizations. I was not expecting a residency here when I reached out. And that is one thing that I would definitely consider in the future is reaching out to places that haven't offered residencies, but seeing if they would be interested in developing something. That's been so exciting here. So I would certainly encourage people who are interested in artist residencies to just inquire. Yeah. You never know what might happen.
Rapid fire question. Like if I'm, if I'm walking around out in the park and I need to dye something yellow, what am I going for?
Right now it might be difficult because it's just, there's been a frost. But
time and season,
okay.
Or no
time and
no
season object, yeah. Okay, I would say marigolds. If there's marigolds growing, those are my favorite source of just, you can pick the flower, that's great. Another one that I use a lot is Osage orange wood. That one's a little bit more tricky because you don't really want to cut down a tree, but if there's any fallen branches, you can gather some of the wood chips from that, and that makes a really bright yellow as well, and both of those things grow here.
What about red? What if I'm out and I'm needing something red?
Ooh, red. Red locally, that's a little bit tough.
And I just also want to point out for the audience, there's a difference between staining and dyeing.
Oh yeah, for sure. There's a lot of misconception that you can just grab any berry you see and it will dye your cloth a beautiful purple or something. And it might for a minute, but it will fade if it's not. If the fabric isn't properly treated and you're not using a plant that is a known dye plant. Yeah, so red, there's a lot of, some people have had good luck with pokeberry. The term is fast for keeping the dye in the fabric is fast if it lasts over time. Having a fast dye with pokeberry, I haven't had great luck. So I usually use madder root, which is not native, but I do grow it in my dye garden at home.
So where's madder root originally from then?
Asia and Europe. It would have been imported here for sure in the colonies.
And total wild card, any other colors out there that might surprise us?
Well, I've been very recently in my home studio getting some really exciting purples from oak leaves, the tannins in oak leaves with iron. The iron and the tannins react to get some really beautiful purple shades, which if you just do the iron, it's gray, and the oak by itself is sort of a brown. But when you combine them, you can get really cool purple tones.
Yeah.
So a little bit of chemistry.
Yeah. I was about to say, this is art. This is chemistry. Yeah. This is...
So it's so exciting about dyeing. Yeah.
Are there any colors, because a lot of the ones you've talked about, mm-hmm. you can almost guess what colors on a get, mm-hmm. but are there any like ones you can think, oh, when you dye this, dye or use this object or plant, it comes up with a color so different than what someone would expect?
Let me think. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that is like shockingly different from what you would expect. I think the thing that gets people most in my experience is how hard the color green is to get, because green is just so prevalent in the natural world. People often think you can just use leaves or grass or whatever, but you actually, there's no plant that will just dye something green without a mordant like the iron or mixing a blue and a yellow dye to get to green. So that's always a little bit of a fun surprise for people.
I'll say I would have no idea on that. I would have thought you could use like copper or something.
Yeah, well, copper or iron, yeah. People do use those to shift browns to more of like an olive or a nice park ranger green. But yeah, like a Lincoln green, you really need indigo and a yellow dye.
That's a cool fact I had no idea on when it comes to dyeing.
Yep. So just remember, when you have grass stains in your clothes, or your kids have grass stains in their clothes, they have not dyed their clothes.
Yes, it might stain it for a while.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode. We want to give a special thank you to Celine Jarvis for her beautiful work and for this interview. And since we're highlighting artists on this episode, we also want to give a special thank you to the band Wolf Patrol for providing the acoustic music we use at the beginning and end of each episode. So thank you. If you are interested in becoming an artist in residence at George Washington Birthplace, please contact us through our social media or our website. On our next episode, we're going to be turning back to the past. We'll be hearing from someone who has an intimate knowledge of our park because they saw it being built in the 1930s with their own eyes. You'll hear their story with their own voice as we open up a portal to the past on the next episode of Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments.